Yeah, you're like a bull in a china shop, aren't you?
I am. I'm a tired old metaphor. So
you're like an apple a day. That's why I try to keep you away.
That's probably for the best.
Do you ever you mixed your metaphors at all?
Do I mix my metaphors? No, I know someone that may or may not be married to you that does.
Yeah, she's terrible as it relates to idioms. Now, how is an idiom different than a metaphor?
Well, yeah, they aren't exactly the same, are they?
Right.
Metaphors and analogies and maybe idioms and colloquialisms and things like that are not all necessarily together. But the idea that, you know, what you're saying is, you know, the meaning is indirect or the meaning is understood in a certain culture, which is always very interesting, especially when you travel. You don't realize that some idioms, or things that are kind of colloquial Americanisms are what they are.
Give me an example. You do quite a bit of international travel. You've, of course, been to Japan. You've been to Europe quite extensively. So is there something that you know that translates? And it's particularly difficult in comedy, right?
Of course, right? Yeah. I can't tell you how many people I know from, you know, that aren't native English speakers will tell me, like, they have no understanding of why Seinfeld was popular or shows that really require you to have not just a basic grasp of English, but you really have to be fluent in English to be able to get the humor. And, you know, part of that, I think what's so daunting about this, I think we just talked about this a grizz or two ago, is the English language has more words in it than any other language. We have like 30 words to say the same thing. There's a million words to express being angry or whatever. So that can be very, very difficult for people who speak other languages, I guess I should say. But you were saying about, you know, is there a specific Americanism kind of thing that jumps out at me that doesn't translate? And nothing really like immediately springs to mind when you say that. But I'm sure as we're going along today, we'll probably end up using one.
Mm-hmm.
I was always kind of surprised at the loose appropriations. A European friend of mine had told me once when I used the expression "the world is your oyster," that in the translated version of what he assumed was the closest version that he knew in his language was "the world is your grape." Just weird things like that. I always find kind of intriguing.
Yeah, but my wife does have a problem with mixing her metaphors and or screwing up her idioms. So she'll say things like, "Fool me once, you know, shame on you. Fool me. Don't. I'm not going to get fooled again." Like she, or she'll say,
she's working from the George W. Bush book of idioms and colloquialisms.
Right. She studied his book. He put out a book on idioms, so she learned from him.
Right.
That's one of my favorites. I mean, that is one of my favorite sound bites of his of all time. Right. He's like, fool me once, shame on you. You know, fool me twice. And he couldn't think of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not going to get fooled again.
Wasn't there recently, within the last 6 months or so, like a biography of him issued that like attempted to make him seem less dumb? You know what I mean?
There was always
a Bush apology biography, more or less.
I'm sure there are always, you know, people who work in his administration who are going to release books all in an effort to make money, of course, but I don't know. I'm sure. You know, and look, I used to read a lot of those political books back in the day, you know, if it was, the different campaign tomes that come out, right? John Kerry running for office, and he releases, you know, a call to service or whatever it is. Joe Lieberman in praise of public life, and these other books. I mean, I think I have a shelf.
Could you have constructed a duller title than in praise of public life?
Well, would you expect anything less than from Joe Lieberman?
And like, just like quick refresh my memory. Who is Joe Lieberman?
He's the Connecticut senator who is as dull as they get. In fact, I think someone like fell asleep at one of his campaign speeches, like next to, he just like collapsed and fell over. He was so boring. He looks like, and I can't remember the guy. He might have been one of the Hanna-Barbera cartoon character types. I'm not gonna go look at. And I can't think of his name. Who? He's got like a very dour.
Is he a blue dog?
Yes. Who
like
is that?
Droopy something or other.
Right. What? I wish I knew what that one was.
He's a contemporary of Huckleberry Hounds, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah. That Lieberman doesn't really ring a bell, but his book title sounds dreadfully dull. Like that must have really burned up the bestseller list with a firebrand-like title in praise of public life.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the book was, and if I remember correctly, it was about the whole argument, the whole theme of the book was about how we shouldn't have term limits, that we really should have career politicians who spend like 30 years in public life.
Ah.
Because you're able to then develop and cultivate relationships in your backyard and have all sorts of, you know, influence and be able to. Basically, it was a book arguing for pork projects. You know, it was like, if you're here for 30 years, chances are you're probably going to have all sorts of defense contract friends and different folks that you're going to send money back home to your home state. You know, you're going to have highway projects that run right near the Walmart in your home city. I mean, that's essentially what the book was. I mean, there is something to be said for, having no term limits. I mean, there's something to be said for having term limits, right? Then you can't be corrupted by. I mean, that's not to say that can't happen, but it's less incentive. You know, there's less incentive for you to spend all of this time and money trying to court wealthy donors and getting on someone's good list so that you're likely to return a favor. But that's what the whole book was about.
Wow. Now, I'm very sincere here. There is a world of political terminology that I simply do not understand, like pork projects, special interests, or Lieberman's.
Or even pork fried rice.
Can you give me an overall, the dumbest down or dumbed downest version of what a pork project is?
Well, here's one of my favorite examples from Boeing, right? There was a great documentary a few years ago called Why We Fight. I think John McCain is scattered throughout the documentary commenting on the bloated defense budget as it has now become. And it's framed in this farewell message by President Eisenhower. And in his farewell address in the 1950s, he said, beware of the military-industrial complex, that we shouldn't have a standing army this large. And here, you know, he was the former Allied commander, right? Led D-Day invasion, brought down Hitler, and so forth, saying, look, we don't need to have this massive standing army because it's just going to lead to corruption. It's just going to lead to big defense contracts that we don't need. Sure enough, he was right. You know, we're now at $700 billion a year for our defense budget. But one of the, you know, pork projects comes from Boeing, which I love. And it's not necessarily a pork project. A lot of these programs are justified. But Boeing, in an effort to get in the good graces of every member of the House of Representatives and the Senate, basically built a part of their infrastructure in all 50 states. So now, if Mike Quackenbush is running for Congress, he's not likely to vote against something that shows up in the defense budget bill as, you know, some project for gas masks or some airplane part that Boeing's making that the Pentagon says, look, we don't even need this thing. Why are we even buying it? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to lose jobs back home in my district. I've got Boeing workers that depend on me, right? So now in all 50 states, you've got people who are responsible for that. So another pork project might be, Your congressman, you know, Rick Santorum was famous for this. He was quite, you know, in the late 90s called sort of like the king of pork for the pork projects he would bring home. He was involved with a lot of different congressmen for bringing pork projects home. And the idea is that there's a bridge in Reading, Pennsylvania that needs fixing. And he's going to somehow in a transportation bill appropriate some pork money, some funding. Basically, just pork. The notion of pork is it's just that it's, you know, it's bloated, wasteful government spending. Now, a lot of these projects are good, right? Some of them need to happen.
Right, we need bridges in Reading, Clayton.
You do need bridges.
There's all those chasms.
You wouldn't be able to cross, right? What are you going to do?
Gorges.
You're going to have to get Sky Commander's backpacks and try to cross all of them. What are you going to do?
No. Oh, Sky Commanders.
But, I mean, people make fun of some of the pork projects that end up getting the headlines, right? Like in Florida, building a bridge, a passageway so that like an endangered frog species can cross this road by having its own bridge or this tunnel.
Wow.
Underneath a bridge. And this
I actually know that story. And I, like I said, I don't know anything about pork or Lieberman's or Congress.
There, of course, if you've heard the bridge to nowhere in Alaska, there is going to be like a $45 million bridge project from one portion of the mainland to this tiny island. And literally no one lived on the island. There were like three people. And yet it was getting like a $45 million bridge project that it was obviously there to some sort of, you know, someone greased the palms of some politician to get this project brought there.
Right. Now, there is a Starbucks on that island.
Right. It's the only thing there. And that's why you'd want a bridge to go.
Right. You know what I mean? Sometimes you put that in your GPS, find the closest one, and like, hope there's a bridge that goes out to this little island here.
Oh, man. So is it hot as hell down by you? My God. It's only May. What is going on around here?
I've not been to hell, but I've been to New Jersey. And it is hot. It's as hot as Jersey, where I am. Uncomfortably so.
Yeah. Now
yesterday was uncomfortably hot, too.
Yeah. And you're the one of these people who, you don't leave the house or go outside normally.
I would try not to. Because, the sun is out there.
Right. And so now when the sun is out and it's ridiculously humid, this is something that you try to avoid at all costs.
I
can imagine yesterday was more like that. I went to a Mets-Phillies game yesterday.
And what were you thinking?
Man, I don't know. It was beautiful. You know, it was a great game. But it was like swamp, swamp-like temperature. I was waiting for like Swamp Thing to come by. Mm-hmm. So stinking hot, and then it is again today. So I can only imagine by August what it's going to feel like, which is always when my dad would want to schedule vacations, was August. Sure. I don't know what it was with our dads. They were sort of like getting to the end of the summer, and it's like, you know, all right, before we kind of go back to school, let's schedule a week, but let's make it like August 15th through the 23rd or something like that, and you're going to go we're going to go to like Orlando in August. And go to one of the theme parks in August.
Well, I think it probably has to do with the fact that, toward the end of the season, you can get discounts on places like that. And certainly something that could be said of both our fathers is that they were on the frugal side.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess, and we're actually, I want to pick your brain about this because you're an international traveler. Of some ill repute, and we're looking at doing an international travel in September. We're thinking about it. So it's my understanding. In fact, my wife.
You want me to dissuade you? Is that what this is going toward?
No. I want you to. I want you to help me. I want you to help me figure this out. Now, I've heard this from a number of places, and my friend who travels like. Three times a week. Like he'll fly to Buffalo, and then from Buffalo he'll fly to like South Carolina on the same day, then he'll fly back home. He has an incredible number of frequent flyer miles. It would make your head spin. So I was asking him, is this true? And he said yes. And I wanted to get some corroboration from you, which is that at Tuesday at like 3 p.m. is the best time to book flights.
Yeah, I've heard that. My belief is from like Monday morning through end of business Tuesday, anywhere in there is where the most attractive rates are going to be. Now, to really try and pinpoint that to the moment, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that a lot of the aggregator sites really refresh their information all that frequently. But my feeling is, and this has always been my experience, from the start of business Monday to the end of business Tuesday, if you book your travel in there, you're going to get the best prices.
And East Coast time. So we're talking East Coast time, end of business, 5 p.m. On a Tuesday. Yeah, I've heard that the weekend rates have sort of refreshed. And then by Tuesday, a lot of the airlines, and we had a travel expert on the show talking about this once before, and she was saying, that all the airlines sort of get together. They sort of try to outdo each other on discounted rates and they're sort of refreshing their weekend rates, and once they hit on Tuesday, they're sort of doing it all at right around Tuesday, like at 3 in the afternoon. It's like the best time. So we're trying to book some international travel and trying to get those things taken care of. Now, one of the things I wanted to do was, and I thought, well, if you're going to travel, one of the issues is I can't sit and fall asleep, right? I can't sit upright in those stinking seats and fall asleep overnight.
Well, ask not for a seat that stinks. And I think that might be a big step forward.
That was what JFK said at his inauguration.
Is it?
Ask not for a seat that stinks.
But
I don't know what the I don't know how to mix my idiom there.
The world is your grape,
right? So, have you ever taken one of those international flights where you get to lay down? They have like a bed.
No, I think that's generally like. Business or envoy class or first class that has those special seats. I don't know. I think I'd be really self-conscious about that kind of thing. Like, you know, when it drives me nuts. When
are you worried about being groped?
Well, no, that's never really been a concern of mine. Anytime, like,
incentive, really.
You pay extra for that. Anytime you have to put your seat down, like, into somebody's lap, or someone does that to you, like, oh, that makes me very edgy.
No, but these are designed, you know what I'm talking about? These are like Lufthansa or British Airways.
British Air has them, yeah.
They're like the pod, you know. And I have a feeling, because I'm tall, right? I'm 6'2". I have a feeling they're probably designed for someone 5'8".
Right.
So, like Davy Jones would have been perfectly happy on a flight.
Right. Especially now that he's dead. Mm-hmm. No complaints from Davy.
Cargo.
Yep. He's in there with 8 maracas and a tambourine.
Oh. Yeah. So I got to do that today. But you have a bit of traveling coming up. And I have to think things over at Chikara headquarters are probably a little crazy right now as you gear up for your big, 10th anniversary show?
My goodness. Well, the 10th anniversary just passed, actually.
Oh, the 10th anniversary just passed.
It did. The actual date of that was May 25th, this past Friday, concluded our 10th year. And so the following day, we embarked on our 11th year. But our big mid-season iPay-per-view event is this Saturday. Chikarasaurus Rex, How to Hatch a Dinosaur, is this Saturday from the Trocadero Theater. And we're just a block down from where the Wizard World convention's going on all weekend. So if you're going to be over at Wizard World, which is sort of like the nexus of pop culture and nerdism, which is exactly where I'll be, come on over then, Saturday night, to the Trocadero. There are still tickets available online, or you can get them at the box office there at the Troc. 7 p.m. sharp, we start 7 mega matches, fill up the card. If you can't be there live, you can watch it live on GFL.tv. Look for Chikarasaurus Rex over there and stream it direct to your computer, your mobile device, or via Roku onto your TV. We would certainly appreciate it if you did. The whole wacky cast of characters from the Chikaraverse will be there, including me. And I'll also be over at Wizard World, so stop by the Chikara booth.
Is this in Philly?
It most certainly is. It's right in Philadelphia. So if you're going to be in the area, swing by Wizard World, come by and see us. And then, of course, the Trocadero is one block up Arch Street from the convention center.
Nice, nice. So does this kick – this isn't like kick off the season officially. Or I guess it does, right? Or
well, no. This is really like the middle of the season. And then you know, we usually wrap things up a little bit before Christmas toward the end of the year. We like to take a chunk of December and January off. To sort of lick our wounds and recuperate.
Yeah. All of your war injuries.
Indeed. And you know, I'm very much looking forward to – I'm not far from getting evaluated at physical therapy because I would like to get a progress report on how I'm doing with my wrist because I have to do all these very, like, mundane, repetitive exercises and things like that, and it's already wearing on my patients.
Yeah. When I broke my ankle, I had to do that where – and it was annoying, and you don't do it. And if you don't do it, you really lose that range of motion. You know, they have you doing, like, the band with the – you got to pull it up, and you got to, like, twist your ankle down to the left, to the right, up and down, over and over and over again. They had me on some ball thing. Do you remember when I broke my ankle? That was a miserable time.
When was that?
It was – boy.
Were we still playing water polo at that time?
Well, it was – I think it was my junior year. It would have been – I think it was my junior year. Or maybe it was right as you went off to college maybe. It was in the fall. Right. It was in the either the – yeah, it would have been my – I think like fall of my junior year or maybe fall of my senior year. Were you around when I broke my ankle? Do you remember
that? See, that's the thing. Like I really can't place it on my mental timeline. So I do wonder if that's when I had left for Pitt. I'm not really sure. But, you know, I do remember that season that you were on the sidelines when you were not actively playing water polo, and you were the only cheerleader that we had. You had those red and white bulldog pom-poms. And
yeah, it was really very much like Will Ferrell on Saturday Night Live in the cheerleading duo.
Yeah, he used to fire us up, you and of course, Sherry O'Terry.
We're going to take a break here and thank one of our show sponsors this week, our good friends over at Gazelle.com, because, boy, it is summertime, and it is gearing up to be a hot season in the technology world. You know, I'm going to be heading out to WWDC, which is the Worldwide Developers Conference in San Francisco. June 11th, I'll be out there in San Francisco covering the big Apple press conference. Of course, E3 is happening the week prior to that, the big video game Expo. And then also you got Google I.O., which is coming up, their conference. You have all these big, you know, video game conferences, and you have Comic-Con in the middle of the summer. So some big consumer electronics releases and information probably coming out very soon. And when that happens, it's always a good time to, you know, maybe you think about trading in your current gadget. Maybe you've got an iPhone 4S, or maybe you've got the older iPhone 4, or maybe you're thinking about upgrading. You know, I get emails all the time from people say, hey, you know, should I wait till the iPhone 5? What should I do? And
they're not making a fifth one of those, are they?
They're probably just going to call it iPhone, given the fact that the new iPad is not iPad 3, but just iPad. Right. So, yeah, they're not going to be making an iPhone 5. It'll probably just be called iPhone. But, you know, it's always a good time to upgrade. And what, you know, Mike knows very well how Gazelle.com works, and it's great for getting rid of your used electronics and making some cash.
That's true. You know, the best time, really, to find out what your used consumer electronics are worth is right now, because the longer you hold on to these, the more value that they lose. So you might be surprised. Head over there now and find out what your iPhone 4 or your iPhone 3GS is worth, your iPad 2, those really are the names, by the way, Apple, sorry, MacBook Air, maybe you've got an iPod Touch or a Samsung Galaxy or any other kind of smartphone. Go over to Gazelle.com right now and find out what these are worth. You might be really surprised at how much money you could make toward upgrading to your next gadget or just putting money right into your pocket. You'll get a risk-free offer from them that's going to stay valid for 30 days while you decide if you can live without this gadget of yours, and then you can send it off for free because Gazelle pays the shipping. Free shipping, fair prices, and it's a fast turnaround from these guys. You're going to see that money. It's going to show up in your mail in check form. It'll zip right into your PayPal account. That's magic money. Or you get 5% extra when you opt for the Amazon.com gift card. Waste no time, members of the Egghead Army. Please go and see great show sponsor Gazelle.com today to find out what your gadget is worth. When you're checking out, you need to let them know that it was us here at the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe and the Greater Grizzly Productions Network that told you about them, because it is only thanks to sponsors like Gazelle and Cobra, who we'll tell you about a little bit later, that we are able to continue to deliver this podcast to you free every week.
That's right. So in that little drop-down menu, how did you hear about us? There's a little drop-down menu that says click on the podcast thing, and then just says which podcast, and click on Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Or you can just hit, you know, Grizzly Productions, whatever strikes your fancy in that moment. So anyway. Hey, I was listening to the other day, and do you know that it struck me as, I don't know that I've listened to this song, We Are the World.
Oh.
And cared much to continue listening to it until the other day.
Right.
And I sat intrigued. Now, I was listening on Sirius Satellite.
Were you trying to figure out who was singing which verses?
Right. I mean, that's part of the fun of it, right?
Totally. Like, oh, that's Boy George, and there's George Michael, like, and there's somebody, I'm not sure who that was, and...
I was listening on Satellite XM, the 80s on 8 station on Sirius or XM, whatever it is. And it was on, and I just, you know, rather than flipping, I was like, you know, this is a pretty good song. Mm-hmm. It really is. When it all comes together and the way in which this thing, you know, Quincy Jones and the involvement, if I'm remembering my history of this, how they managed to get everyone together to pull this off.
Right. It was like a Quincy Jones, Michael Jackson project.
Right. And Michael Jackson, like, wrote the lyrics, didn't he? And they were surprising at how quickly he had written it, if I'm remembering. And Quincy Jones.
He wrote it that afternoon. Like, people were coming to the studio to do this. Like, everybody that was anybody in the 80s. And if you watch the video, there's some people in there that you're like, why is Dan Aykroyd in there?
Right. Right.
You know, like, how did those guys sneak into the back there? Like, everybody shows up and, like, Michael goes in the corner and writes it and comes out 5 minutes later. He's like, sing this. And then it went on. It was the biggest selling single that year, right? 85 or 84, whatever year We Are the World is. That was the biggest selling single of that year.
Yeah, 1985. And if I'm not mistaken, Harry Belafonte was the one who really wanted to bring it all together, right? Social activist. He had, I guess for a long time, wanted to do it and then kind of enlisted the help of Michael Jackson, I guess, and Quincy Jones to pull it all together. And I was trying to remember if Sting was involved. You know, I had thought that he was, but then as I was listening, I listened to the whole thing. I couldn't hear him at all, so I have to imagine right. He wasn't in there.
Well, there were a lot more people, I think, that were, like, involved than you can hear in the mix. By the way, real quick, Harry Belafonte, if you didn't know, he's a congressman from Connecticut. I think that there were a lot of people that got involved whose voices probably just get lost in the mix because everybody wanted to be part of that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you go down the laundry list of individuals, and are you able to, like, if you hear it now, are you able to name everyone?
I do know who a lot of them are when I hear it, but I couldn't tell you the last time I've heard that. I just kind of remember whenever that last time was that I heard it, probably when I still had XM in my car, I was just like, wow, this one's stacked. Like, there's Lionel Richie for five words.
I'm surprised. You know? Now I'm pulling it up here on the wiki, and sure enough, Sting is not involved. He was not involved in it, although he was, of course, involved in Live Aid at the time. But, if you know, this is when the Police were sort of breaking up, not really together anymore, if you will. They kind of got back together in 1986 for a little bit in the studio and produced nothing other than that Don't Stand So Close to Me 1986 remix.
Which is dreadful.
It's awful. But
Stuart Copeland's brother is on We Are the World. Who's that, Miles? Is that his name?
Miles Copeland, yeah. Right, what is he doing? Is he singing?
He just stood in the back.
But he didn't even sing. I mean, you have people like John Oates, Smokey Robinson, Randy Jackson. I didn't realize Randy Jackson was on this.
The football player.
Randy Jackson from American Idol fame. Of course, he's singing chorus. So there's a whole bunch of people in the background singing on the court. Lindsey Buckingham.
Right.
Chris Hayes.
Let's talk about Lindsey Buckingham for a moment, can we?
Yeah.
Can we talk about Lindsey Buckingham? So real quick, if you don't know his name, Lindsey Buckingham was probably most famous during the commercial height of Fleetwood Mac. He's the male lead vocalist, right? They would split the duties up between him, Stevie Nicks, and Christine McVie. So things like Don't Stop, you know, that's him. That's him out there singing lead. He's got one of the most identifiable voices in rock, but I think most people really don't know his name. You know, Lindsey Buckingham, he's like one of those guys. Like, his name just gets swallowed up by how massive Fleetwood Mac was when they really were at their commercial height. But Lindsey Buckingham is a really kind of oddball. I think anybody that tastes success at the extreme level that the members of Fleetwood Mac did. But in the 80s, as he was kind of like going back and forth between, because Fleetwood Mac wasn't always together as a band, right? Stevie Nicks would go off and do a solo project. Lindsey Buckingham would. Christine McVie even had a hit in the late 80s, right? She had that one-off hit, like an 87, Got a Hold on Me, which is a really memorable song, but one of those like lost hits of the 80s. He made some bizarre music videos, and the 80s were kind of like that's where bizarre music videos went. His were beyond bizarre.
Awful? Or like, you know, when you say bizarre, do you mean awful?
Perhaps. But just like, you know, a lot of those ones from the 80s, they don't hold up well. But if you see them in the context of other 80s videos, you're like, okay, I can kind of like, all right, I'll let that slide. But not the Lindsey Buckingham stuff. I think there's really only two or three, right? There's definitely one for Holiday Road, which is a really bizarre video. There's one for Trouble, which was his highest chart success, even though that's probably not one of his more identifiable ones, which is kind of a weird paradox, I think. And Go Insane, which is always sort of like his signature. I always think of that as like his signature solo hit, don't you?
Yeah, I would say so. What do you think is the worst video? I want to pull it up here and watch it.
Watch that video for Holiday Road. It's really peculiar. So part of this came up, I don't know when this was, I guess VH1 was... They were expanding their brand into a new channel called VH1 Classic. Do you remember when this was happening?
Yeah, this happened, I don't know, a few years ago, right? Like 2007 or so?
And part of their launch of this was that they were going to show every music video that they had in their catalog in alphabetical order. I don't know if you remember when they were doing this or not, but this was a very intriguing thing to me. Gigantic lists of things are fascinating to me. So I tried to watch as much of it as I possibly could, because you're always kind of curious when they say, we're really going to show you everything in our catalog. Like,
okay, here's the video. This makes no sense. Like, there he is. He's in an office at a water cooler.
Right.
He's looking at blue water, and he takes a sip of, like, blue water. Like, really, like, ridiculously colored blue water. But he's, like, in a prison. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, when I think of that song, first of all, I love that song, right?
Right, yeah, it's a very catchy, like, it's a good sing-along song, but that's because of what you associate it with, of that Chevy Chase movie. When you hear that song, I don't think anybody thinks of that video, and with good reason.
It's terrible.
Right.
And I don't understand, am I missing the point of the song? Is it this idea that you want to get out of the office, but he's, like, locked in a prison of being in a 9-to-5 job kind of thing? I don't even know... Because this is what it looks like. He's, like, in a prison in his office. I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. There's all these people just, like, telemarketer types, like, ladies sitting there in front of white phones, and... It's on YouTube. It's god-awful.
Right. Another thing about his videos, a weird quirk, is they seem to go out of their way to make him seem as effeminate as possible.
I was just about to say that. Well, he's wearing eyeliner.
Right. Which, you know, in the 80s...
Right.
You know, he wasn't the only dude doing that. But you would think, growing up with your first name being Lindsay, you would probably have enough of people trying to emasculate you.
Right.
As is. You know, like, some director comes on, they're like, let's put him in as much makeup as possible. You know, and even when he was in Fleetwood Mac, like, you ever see some of that late 70s concert footage of him? Like, they go out of their way to make him seem effeminate. And obviously, he's a super talented artist, one of the greatest guitarists of all time, like an unsung hero of the guitar, like, endlessly creative. But having said that, and this kind of, we've talked about this when we talked about Steve Jobs, we talked about, the same is true of a lot of the guys that we really like, Sting and Nez and other guys like that, is he's infamously difficult to get along with, right? Like, he's just so unbelievably committed and dedicated to what his artistic vision is, and the people that don't get that, you can see, like, he just doesn't suffer them. And I had the opportunity a couple summers ago to see Lindsey Buckingham live in concert. He was in our hometown of Reading, PA, playing the former Raya Theater, which is now called something else. And even on stage now, and he's got to be close to 60, right? He's got to be mid-50s to 60-year-old, I'm guessing. It was like they went out of their way to make him seem really effeminate. And, you know, it's one thing, like Boy George is like an obvious 80s example that jumps to mind, right? Like...
Right.
That dude was made out to be as effeminate as you could possibly be, but that was his image. Like, that was his gimmick. Like, who's in their late 50s thinking, like, can you find a way to light me to make me seem more like a woman? Like, well, what is the thought process there, Lindsay?
Yeah, he really does. There are scenes where, he's, like, sipping this water. He does look really effeminate.
Right. Yeah, I don't get that. I don't understand what the rationale.
There seemed to be. Well, I think that's part of the '80s culture. Right? There was a lot of that androgyny happening, and David Bowie went through his sort of '80s androgyny phase.
Sure. Well, Pete Byrne, you know, the guy from Dead or Alive, like, he's the guy who claims he started all of that. You know, like, in his mind, Boy George ripped him off and all that kind of stuff. And correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know if you know this bit of trivia or not, but he then actually underwent surgery and became a woman, right? Pete Byrne from Dead or Alive?
Did he really? I wouldn't doubt it, though. He was always wearing lipstick and long hair.
Right. He was a cross-dresser for many, many years. And then I think – I could be wrong about this. It's either that or he's just become so incredibly effeminate that the last time I saw him, I was like, he changed. Like, he swapped to the other team. But
from Naked Eyes, though?
No. No, from Dead or Alive. That guy's name is Pete Byrne, too.
Oh, I was like, oh, okay.
Isn't it?
You're probably right.
Let me look this up here. Now you got me thinking. You're right.
Because the Pete Byrne I know is from Naked Eyes, but he always had, like, bushy hair. I just never thought of him as effeminate as Dead or Alive guy.
You're right. No, I'm wrong. Pete Burns.
Burns.
Pete Burns is from Dead or Alive. Pete Byrne is from Naked Eyes. Yeah, but they're both British, both those guys, you know, everybody over there. They've only got, like, five names.
Right.
There's, like, Pete, Nigel, Ian, that's it. And Eric Idle.
Wow, yeah, looking at him in 2008, he's clearly, wow. I mean, he's, like, wearing a dress.
Right.
I mean, I'm looking, yeah, I mean, he's one over the edge. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he does still tour, Pete Byrne. I mean, he had a really famous, like, he was on a reality show or something and had, like, a huge breakdown or something. And, he was back in the tabloids for a while.
He had a single, I guess, that charted at 75th. That's where it hit on the charts. It ranked 75 in 2004. He had his own, he got married to, Here, let me see this. All right, 1970, Burns married hairdresser Lynn Corlett, whom he remained married for 28 years until 06. That year, on the 9th of February, he announced his engagement to his partner, Michael.
Oh.
Where he displayed that they had matching engagement rings. Then the following day, Simpson called off their engagement, citing that he was finding it difficult to deal with the newfound fame, although their engagement was soon back on, and their civil partnership took place on July 6th. Burns appeared on Celebrity Wife Swap.
Interesting.
Which aired on September 2007, where he lived with Neil Ruddock for 5 days. So a gay couple, he switched husbands, or wives, whatever you, I guess husbands. Simpson also took part in the program, the husband. Burns made a statement saying that gay marriage does not work, and that it is better to be married to a woman.
Oh.
All right. There you go.
He's all over the board, is this guy. And he also, by the way, had a very famous lawsuit against his plastic surgeon or whatever.
Right.
That I guess he attributed whatever some of his increasingly feminine features to. By the way, I just found this out as you were reading that I was Googling around here. Lindsay Buckingham is 62. 62 years old is Lindsay Buckingham. Yeah. And by the way, this is also on his Wikipedia page. Thanks for this. Rolling Stone ranked him number 100 out of the 100 greatest guitarists of all time.
Come
kind
on.
Kind of a slap in the face there for Lindsay. Slapping his powdery, effeminate face.
Who's above him?
Well, it doesn't have the rest of the list. I'm pretty sure I remember looking at that list at the same time that 500 greatest albums thing was out, and number one was Jimi Hendrix.
Hmm. By the way, we're doing a lot of wikiing today. I found for Joseph Lieberman, Senator Lieberman, it is Droopy. The cartoon character is Droopy. Yeah. He's an animated cartoon character with a droopy face.
Hmm.
It was Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Cartoon Studio, MGM, in 1943. So, yeah, that's who he is. And I'm sure you'd recognize. You certainly know his sound, right? I mean, the way he talks, you know.
Let me quick – I'm going to look this up here. Polestar is my favorite website to look for concert dates. It might be yours as well. Lindsey Buckingham is currently on tour. He's doing a solo tour, and here it is real quick. In fact, tonight he's in Boston. He's on tour for the next couple weeks. So if you want to get out and see Lindsey Buckingham, go see him. Here's where he's going to be. He'll be in Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut. He's coming to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania on Sunday the 10th. He'll be in Wilmington, Delaware, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Columbus, Ohio. Looks like just over a dozen dates remaining on this tour of his that he's currently on throughout North America, or just the United States, really. And it looks like it's only the eastern part, so maybe he's already done. He's from the West Coast, you know, he's a Californian. So maybe he already covered the West Coast and he's wrapping this up. But he was an excellent, excellent performer when we saw him. But you really did get the sense of... And I remember, I think I've told you this story before about after the fact, a friend of mine who worked at a concert venue even told me that, like, even his own crew hates him. Like, they can't stand dealing with Lindsey Buckingham.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, we got some feedback from last week's show on our Facebook fan page. And we always get some good feedback there. Yeah, we do have a great Facebook fan page for the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Go over and check it out. Elaine Crawford, you, in fact, even texted me regarding something interesting. She posted a cake. I don't know if you saw this thing.
Oh, so what was the name again?
Her name is Elaine Cook.
Elaine Cook.
And this cake, you got to go see this picture that she posted over on the Grizz fan page. How would you describe this cake?
Breathtaking. Right. I would say is the way I would describe it to you. I thought it was remarkable. Every tier of the cake was representative of a different iconic superhero, and it was a mix of DC and Marvel characters. And much time was spent staring at it with my son.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's so funny to look at some of the analytics from our fan page. We had like 347 people like clicked on this thing and saw this cake.
Those were all me.
Those are all superhero fans, or Mike. But yeah, this thing's amazing. Batman is at the top of it. She said she thought that the folks in the cafe would enjoy this at the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. You are right, Elaine. It's got Spider-Man in there, Aquaman, Superman, and the Hulk, I think, rounds out the bottom. Or is that the Thing?
Right. No, there's the Hulk's fist, and the bottom tier of the one I was looking at, Captain America, was the bottom.
Oh yeah, and Robin. Robin makes it up in the middle there too. It's pretty cool. So Elaine, thank you for sending that along. Very cool. That's inspiration. You know, my sister is an amazing decorative sort of cook. I mean, she does this pastry stuff that blows me away. And I don't know how she learned this skill, right? Because I didn't see her practicing this when we were children. But she is, like, for her daughter's first birthday, made a cake that's like, I don't know, this, if it was like an Elmo cake. I forget exactly what it was. But it was this incredibly elaborate cake with like fondant and everything. It looks like the cake.
Fondant.
You know that stuff that they, all of this cake, this superhero cake.
Not fondant, but fondant.
Well, that Cake Boss. You never see that show Cake Boss?
Fondant.
Fondant. Fondant. Do you ever see that Cake Boss show? You know what I'm talking about.
I do know what you're talking. I actually recently watched an episode of a show called Cupcake Wars. So go ahead.
Oh my God. But anyway, the Cake Boss, you know, he uses fondant. That's how you get a lot of the artistry on the outsides of cakes. You know, you can eat it. It is edible, of course, and you slice through it. It's a little thick, and you want to kind of eat around it, I guess. It's like a hardened, sugary whatever. So she made this. I don't even know how you describe it. Anyway, she made this cake that was mind-blowing. You're like, oh, my God, someone should have paid you $300 for that cake, which is, I'm sure, what this cake probably cost, you know, the superhero cake, to have made for some birthday party or something. But
I don't know. I think you're really underestimating what those cakes cost.
Really? Really? I don't know. I have no concept, so.
Well, I'll tell you, because right after the first one of those cake shows arrived, right, it was on TLC. They're based out of Baltimore. It's not Cake Boss, but it's the other one. Ace of Cakes is the name of it. I went on their website and looked, and like the minimum, like they're not even gonna, you know what I mean, they're not doing anything for less than $1,000. Like they said, even a basic cake would be $1,000. And I attended a wedding where they got one specifically from them. They're called Charm City Cakes, and it was a $1,200 cake, and it was not especially elaborate compared to some of the crazy ones you see on those TV shows and things like that. So, I think far more expensive. Now, let me tell you, first of all, the title Cupcake Wars, I think, is a little bizarre. I think that maybe it's too strong. Like, I think Cupcake Squabble might be more appropriate, or something like that. But I watched because
they try to drive up the drama on those shows, though, right?
Boy, do they ever, yeah. You know, I think if I was like the editor for one of those reality shows, I'd want to scratch my eyes out. Like, here's where we, you know, use shots from different things that aren't really what they are to heighten the suspense or whatever, and we put the dramatic music underneath it, and, oh, we're going to commercial. But someone from Reading was on Cupcake Wars and won, which is, and no one from Reading ever wins anything.
Right. I mean, you won something once, right? Like Didn't you win like a journalism award once?
Oh, yes. Yes, you're right about that. But I mean, you know, real things.
Right. Real things.
This woman, she did. She runs, it's right in West Reading, right there on Penn Avenue. She won. She had the best cupcake. And then like a week or so later, I was driving through there, and sure enough, there was like a huge sign in front of her store that said, you know, like Winner Cupcake Wars on Food Network or whatever channel it's on. I was amazed by that. But you must think, did you hear this statistic? And you tell me if I've got it wrong. This is current to this year, that one in every five Americans has been on television.
I've heard that. Yes, you're probably right. And it may be even a little bit higher.
Yeah, and all of them have been on Cupcake Wars.
Apparently anyone can win that show.
Well, I don't know what, you know, I've never been in a cupcake boutique, which is strange given proclivity.
Whoa.
Right? Like, if anybody should have been in one of those,
right,
it should be me.
If anyone should have written a book on it, it should be.
but I've not. And in spite of, so what I'm saying is, I wonder, like, one of those really specialty cupcakes, what do you think one of those costs?
Well, I mean, I imagine if they're for like a wedding, right, where most of the time, and here's the secret, right, I learned this from having, you know, read about this and heard how these things work, because we did a show on it, one of my shows we had we had a bunch of wedding cakes on, and they explained to me that, you know, you buy one of these elaborate cakes and you don't actually eat it. That it's there for presentation, and that, you know, when they you slice the cake up to have to do like the little thing where you wipe it on each other's nose or whatever right. It is.
That comes from a separate cake.
Right, like it's brought out underneath a tarp, you know, and it's just right. Like it doesn't have all the fondant on it and everything. It's just like a piece
fondant.
Of cake. Fondant.
Wasn't that the name of a Batman villain? Fondant.
he's a gay,
one of
he's
Shandell's.
A gay, right, he's a gay pastry chef.
He, the Archer, and Shandell. They formed a fearsome trio in some Silver Age Batman book.
But, you know, so I think the, you know, that main cake is more presentation than it is eating it, you know. And so, yeah, you pay upwards of a couple hundred bucks for it. And I think there was one that, you know, sometimes, like, even these specialty cake places where they get featured in magazines, like these wedding magazines, because I watched on that Cake Boss, you know, he had to make this one that they were going to shoot for a wedding spread. So he was making it in Queens or wherever the hell he makes these cakes. And then he drives, he was like, they put it in this truck. And it's so funny because, you know, it's like back and forth, like him on the CB radio with these guys, like his drivers, which are all like degenerates, you know. And he's like, man, this. He's like, I'm all nervous. You know, we spent 2 weeks making this cake. He's like, in this, you know, I got John and Timmy here. He's the driving. He doesn't even have a license. You know, he's driving over to Manhattan. He's got to go to the photo shoot for Wedding Magazine. And I don't know if he's going to hit a pothole and he's going to ruin my cake. You know, it's like, that's the kind of drama on the show. And so I'm hoping they hit a pothole, right? Mm-hmm. And sure enough, like he like pulls into a parking space and he like hits a telephone pole and half the cake collapses. You know, they got to fix it on the, you know, like in a, and there's like a cake emergency and he's on a CB radio trying to fix the cake and get there in time. And then, yeah, like, you know, the price tag for doing a cake from him specialty is like, you know, I don't know, $1,500. Could you imagine? I mean, I could imagine like a cupcake.
I like pastry way more than most people and no. Yeah, no, I cannot imagine paying that amount. Hey, listen, I'm a little under the weather, and I very badly need to run to the restroom and blow the heck out of my nose. So this is a great opportunity if we want to pause for just a second and talk a little bit about Cobra, and I'll be back lickety-split.
Indeed. So here are our friends at Cobra Eye Radar, the makers of a couple of great products. You know, if you're on the road and you're really concerned about getting pulled over, which is a concern a lot of people have, right? Going through speed traps, etc., and you've got a smartphone. Well, Cobra is the leading company in the smartphone/radar technology department. These guys have paired your smartphone with your radar device, the Cobra Eye Radar. So you download the free application from the iOS store, the Android marketplace, and it's so simple to use. Basically, you just launch the app and you pair it over Bluetooth with the iRadar device. And as you're driving along, you mount it on your, you know, your windshield or wherever you want to put it. It'll actually beep alert you, give you red cam, you know, different camera alerts. It'll let you know all of the different types of radar that are being used by the police in that area. Let's say you're traveling on the Northeast, you know, along the New England area, and you've got to travel through multiple states. Well, a lot of states use different radar. It doesn't matter for the iRadar because it picks it up. It knows all of the different radars that are being used, and you get alerts right there on your smartphone. You can actually tag certain areas. So if you're driving through an area and there's a speed trap, you can tag it to warn you again next time as you're traveling in that same area using GPS. So it'll alert you before you get to that speed trap. Hey, you know, coming up here, you're going to see that same speed trap again. Watch out. It also has a great social mechanism, too. So if Mike is driving ahead of me, maybe he's 20 miles ahead of me on a road trip, we left later, he can actually tag where there's incidents, where there's a police car that he happened to see. And I'll get that alert. Anyone driving that area will get those alerts. So it's real time. They update their database twice daily for red light cameras, all sorts of speed trap information. And the bottom line is, you know, it's not about trying to avoid getting a ticket. It's about being a more alert driver. People who actually use radar detectors in their car are actually safer drivers. They're more alert. They're more aware of what's going on the road. So they tend not to speed. And they also tend to be more aware of what other drivers are doing. So they get into fewer accidents. So this is a big thing from Cobra. Go check them out, Cobra.com. They have a great lineup of products. This is not the only product over there, but they've been a longtime sponsor of this show, and I absolutely love them, especially as your summer road trips are now heating up, getting out there after Memorial Day and starting to plan that week vacation with the family, and you're going to be hitting the road. Pick up a Cobra iRadar, save you a couple hundred bucks on getting that speeding ticket. and also make you a safer driver in the process. Cobra.com. Tell them you heard about them from the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe.
That's right. Shout that at your screen when you're on their website. I heard about you from the Grizz.
Indeed. Is your nose all clean?
More or less.
Hey,
I think the worst part of this has passed. I wanted to ask you really quickly. You know, in just under 2 weeks, Sting is in your neck of the woods. Are you going to see him?
What? It's still on the same, on the Back to Base tour?
It's not being advertised as the Back to Base tour. It might still be that, though.
Hmm. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what they were calling the last tour. I mean, that's what sort of some of the nomenclature was saying, and I got the T-shirt as such, but I don't know that that's what it was called. It was just Sting. You know, I don't know.
Right.
I have to imagine it probably is a continuation of the tour that I saw him. When did I see him? It was October, maybe, in Philly, in the Tower Theater.
I don't know. I mean, I know, I would trust that you probably recall that.
Remember.
Better than I do.
But it was a great, it was a really great show. I have to say, of all the Sting shows I've seen, it was my favorite. And I've seen him 5 or 6 times now. So
well, here's the current set list. I'll give you a little insight into this here, what his current set list is. And this is current as of last week. He's playing All This Time, Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic, Englishman in New York, 7 Days, Demolition Man, I Hung My Head, Driven to Tears, Fields of Gold, Sacred Love, Shape of My Heart, Inside, Ghost Story, Love is Stronger Than Justice, The Hounds of Winter, The End of the Game, Never Coming Home, Desert Rose, King of Pain. That's the set list.
Wow. No.
So
these are all, I mean, I would say about half of that set list I saw.
Mm.
Certainly did not play King of Pain.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't played that in years.
Mm-hmm.
The
End of the Game, I thought, that's a fun kind of like hidden gem of his catalog. I really like Inside. That's like one of my favorite latter period Sting hits. Of course, I Hung My Head. He just beats that one to death. Like, give me the rest of Mercury Falling, Gordon Sumner.
Yeah. What else did you mention? 7 Days. Yes.
Right. I really like 7 Days. I'm glad you mentioned that. That's one of my favorites of his, too. I really dislike Demolition Man.
Yeah, I'm not a Demolition Man fan. I don't know why. I don't know why he wants to play that one. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there was another one you mentioned in there that I've never seen him play, I think.
Love is Stronger Than Justice, I thought was a weird one.
He played that. He did like a little country stint in the middle of his set. He played Love is Stronger Than Justice.
Ghost Story seemed like an odd pick to me. Shape of My Heart.
Yeah, he did not play Shape of My Heart when I saw him, so that's another one in the mix. So I don't know. Maybe he's just like having some fun with some of his off-peak songs.
Right.
That's cool.
So,
When is he here?
I believe it's June 11th he's out near you. If you're ever interested to find out if your favorite artists are coming by you, let me plug them once again for you. That's Polestar.com, Polestar.com. They do tend, and it's worldwide dates. I mean, you'll find dates if you want to go see somebody in Europe, you want to see them in South America, whatever. I think this is the trick. If a major ticket retailer is vending the tickets, you can find it. So really tiny acts, you know, where maybe they handle tickets internally, you will not see them listed here. But like if they go through Ticketmaster, Ticketweb, or any of those types, that's how these get reported to Polestar, and they find the dates and list them for you. And just a wealth of information there, and it does tend to be extremely up to date.
That's great. That's great. Also, I'm trying to go see The Wall. That's my goal. And apparently on StubHub, I've been hearing from some people I work with that said that, you know, they got at Yankee Stadium, they got Wall tickets for, you know, pretty inexpensive. And like in grandstand seating, they did, got some, you know, decent prices. And because the stuff that I heard was like $500. So, you know, I don't know. But this stuff was like $40, $50, $60. I was like, wow. And they're like, yeah, I thought it was going to be well worse than that. So anyway, also last week we were talking about the guy, the crime boss in The Dark Knight Rises, or The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. Or no, I'm sorry, Batman Begins. And we couldn't think of his name. It was Falcone.
Falcone, yes.
And thanks to Dan Peck for writing that and posting that on our Facebook fan page.
Tom. Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan. Posted, he said his, you know, the actor's name is Tom Wilkinson.
Right. Way to make us seem dumb, Dan.
It doesn't take much. Did you see One of the things we had tweeted this week, Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter, we found...
Oh, we have a Twitter.
We do. Oh. But, you know, you follow. one of the things that we posted that we found Grizzworthy was Daniel Radcliffe as the Flash.
Mm.
Of course, Daniel Radcliffe, who plays Harry Potter.
Right, he played Harry Potter well into his 40s.
And we asked the question, can you see this? Now, apparently... Nope. Now, well, who knows, right? Apparently, it's not that he's been cast as the Flash. It's that he would like to play the Flash, that he has an affinity for the Flash, which I find interesting.
Right. I'd like to play the Flash, too. I mean, put me on that list.
Right, but you're not a good actor.
You don't know that.
I do. So he says there are... Well, let's see. What does it say about this? Yeah, so they asked him what he would want to play. He says, "I think they've all been done. I don't think anyone's done The Flash yet, and that's probably one that I would have a go at. Other than that, I'm not sure which other comic book character heroes are out there." And my wife asked me this the other day, and I didn't know the answer, although I don't think it's in any sort of pre-production or anything, which is The Flash, right? I mean, we talked about it, and I don't know that it got off the launch pad, did it?
No. You know, there was a lot of talk after the failed live-action Justice League movie that I think we were talking about this like in the very earliest Grizzly Bear Egg Cafes, and, you know, now that we've been doing this for quite a little while, you know, nothing has really surfaced. Of course, I'm sure you're familiar with the phrase development hell. You know, the idea that things just get tied up in all this red tape and progress is so slow. And certainly that's been the case with a lot of things surrounding the Justice League movie, which had gone into pre-production in New Zealand for a short period of time and then was canceled. They pulled the plug on it. And, you know, subsequently, like, a script was leaked that involved killing the Flash in the final act of the film. Fans were really like, what? Then Warner Brothers, who owns DC Comics, and DC Comics is the parent of all those, you know, those iconic Justice League characters, Superman, Batman, The Flash, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, Green Lantern, etc. And, of course, over the years, they've acquired a lot of other characters that are equally famous and integrated them into their universe, like Captain Marvel, who's now been renamed Shazam, and Plastic Man, among others. That what they felt they had to do was establish each of the Justice League's main players in their own movie, a la the build of the Avengers, before you could bring them all together into a group film. And so, you know, the Superman Man of Steel movie, which is out next year, might be thought to be part of that. You remember that they tried to make Wonder Woman into a television property. They got that pilot done, but no one would buy it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there had been a lot of talk about doing The Flash as a movie, but all that talk seems to have vanished. It really seems like, you know, maybe they just kind of put that out there to, like, appease people who felt teased by the idea of a live-action Justice League of America movie. I think what's great about the just overwhelming success of The Avengers is that it must prove to people that you can make a movie like that,
right?
Like, those are that's an assembly of larger-than-life characters and personalities, and it can be done, and obviously it can be profitable. It's wildly profitable.
Yeah, especially if they do it well by having the origin stories told ahead of time, as we've talked about here on the show. So, I don't know. I mean, and they could do a one-off Flash film and then roll it into a Justice League film later. I mean, I don't know. I have to see. We'll have to see. Is there anything else on the docket this week?
Well, I'll tell you what. Hang on for just a sec. I'm curious to know this right now. And if you don't, what I'd like to do is I'm gonna look it up. Let's find out where the Avengers stands right now on the all-time list. Let's see, because
Sunday, I think it was fifth.
Well, the last time I looked, it was already to fourth.
Oh, really?
So I was curious if it had made it all the way to third, because it just kind of continues to shatter box office records here.
Yeah, because Men in Black 3 beat them this week, finally. Mm. So that Men in Black 3 was the first one to do that.
Astonishing to me that anyone has any interest in that movie whatsoever. Right, so wait, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Over 10 box office records it holds right now. Yeah, it is the fastest movie to reach $500 million. It bumped Avatar from that spot. It did in 23 days what Avatar did in 32.
So yeah, it's number four all time domestically right now, $523.6 million.
Mm-hmm. But like the worldwide, I wouldn't even know where to find this information. Like the just like all time worldwide box office.
Yeah, I don't know where that is now.
Yeah, I wouldn't know where to go to find that list. But you know, the thing about it is, I think Marvel has taken just tremendous care in the way that they sort of ushered this whole thing together. And that's not to say that Warner Brothers would not, but their track record when it comes to delivering consistency in the genre is far spottier than Marvel's.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Green Lantern, what a travesty that one was.
I even forgot about that. As we were talking about that, like, I forgot about that. My brain always just, like, always goes to, like, Halle Berry Catwoman.
Speaking of DC, have you seen the new Dark Knight Rises posters? We tweeted a couple of them this week from our Grizz account that we found Grizz-worthy, and they're pretty nice. They're pretty nice. It shows, like, the flaming bat behind him, like the city's on fire kind of thing.
I think all the posters, I think I've seen four different posters, and Batman's not in any of them.
Here's an awesome one. This one's really, really sweet. I'm going to send this to you on your Skype here. Check this out. Oh. This is pretty cool. This is the Dark Knight Rises, and it's like an IMAX style. I mean, it's like 16:9 aspect ratio. Do you see this?
This is very interesting.
Yeah.
What a strange poster that is.
It is.
I'm just standing on a car.
He's standing on a police car, and it looks like all the police cars are just like trashed, and Batman's just standing on top of them, and there's just like this massive crowd gathering in the distance. Pretty cool. But the reason I send you this story is because, I don't know if you heard, like, 2012 MTV Movie Awards on June 3rd, they're going to release some exclusive footage.
Right, that's this Sunday night.
And again, I don't want to see that stuff.
No, I don't either. You know, they released a four-minute chunk of The Amazing Spider-Man a couple weeks ago, and people were asking, oh, did you watch that? No. No, and I will not.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's a pretty cool poster. But there are some of the other posters. Let me see if I can find the other ones.
Such a strange poster. I just keep looking at it. Like,
right.
It's really odd. I really did like that one where, like, you're looking up through the skyscrapers and the part of the sky that's exposed formed the bat symbol. Like, I really liked that one.
But that's that was from Dark Knight, right? Are you theory talking?
No, I think that was the very first Dark Knight Rises poster.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, the skyscrapers are crumbling, and it's falling down toward you, toward your perspective, and it forms the bat symbol in the negative space.
Right. Now, that's the same idea, the concept here. I'm going to send you this one. This is the one that's on fire. Take a look at this. This is sweet. See that there?
Oh, it's loading now. My 56K takes a little while, Clayton.
You're on your BBM.
Yeah, this one's cool. It's kind of like the same idea.
Right.
You know, it's just like they photoshopped him in front of it.
Right, and the bat behind him is on fire, the looking up through. And it just says, a fire will rise. The Dark Knight Rises. Yeah, and even in that poster that I sent you, the first one, it says, you know, like, the legend ends. So I think you're right in your assessment. I re-listened to, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, where we were talking about the Dark Knight trailer that we had seen. And you were saying that you thought, you know, they're really trying to play up this idea that he dies.
Right.
And so I think you even see that in the movie poster, you know, says, the legend ends and all this sort of.
Yeah, so. they definitely want to. I saw a really interesting speech, I guess is what I want to say, an oration about storytelling, and you know, the idea that you would couple the key elements of anticipation and uncertainty together, and that really seems to be the underlying theme of the marketing for The Dark Knight Rises, right, is that everyone has this anticipation for the final installment of the trilogy based on the fact that The Dark Knight was such an excellent film. And then they've added to it this uncertainty about it, because certainly if you know your Batman mythology, you realize they wouldn't be bringing Bane along unless he was, as he did in the comic books, he's coming to break the bat. But to take that even further, you know, they have certainly overtly implied in the marketing here that they're going to kill Batman. Now, I would wager to say they're probably not going to follow through on that, but boy, they really do want you to think that, and that threat of uncertainty, I think, is really one of the key attractions to this. Because while some of it is very compelling, right, like what they've done with the Bane character, I think this movie version of Bane, the snippets we've seen, or like that six-minute prologue we discussed an episode or two ago, have made him far more fascinating. There's a lot about this that is not as intriguing, Selina Kyle. You know, there, like the fact that there's all this media out there and like Batman's virtually absent from all of it. Like, I don't go to a Batman movie to see Selina Kyle. I go to see Batman.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to see. There's a lot happening in that because Christian Bale coming out admitting that there could be another Batman film. Says that, you know, it seems appropriate that this would be the end point. He said, however, if Christopher Nolan does come to him with a fourth script, he would be very likely to do it, he says.
Right. Let me just say this. Christopher Nolan, Christian Bale, regardless, spoiler, there will be another Batman movie.
Yeah, true. Now, whether it includes either of them.
Right. This is not the last Batman movie.
You know, I was thinking about that the other day. It would be fascinating to see. And I would be a little nervous to see. I mean, we see the reboot, right? I didn't think anyone could do Spider-Man perhaps better than the way Sam Raimi brought it to the screen.
Right.
You know, he did a great job bringing it, at least in the first two films. It certainly wasn't a fitting end to the Spider-Man trilogy with his Spider-Man 3. But now I'm encouraged by the way The Amazing Spider-Man is looking with Andrew Garfield and the like. It seems to be coming together in a way that I could be pleasantly surprised.
Right.
Now, let me say this, though, about the Batman films. It seems to me that I don't know that anyone could do it better than Christopher Nolan, right? Mm-hmm. I think he's redefined the superhero film, perhaps forever, mm-hmm. The way that he's done the Batman films. And, I've been so captivated by his work I'm just thrilled to see the third one, that I don't know that I could ever picture another director doing it as well. And what would they bring to it, right? How differently would you need to do it to sort of to put your own stamp on it?
Well, first of all, Bob Trait as Two-Face.
Our high school Batman film. you as the Riddler.
Thank you.
And we'll use my 1989 Ford Escort, where I wasn't able to actually drive it yet, for the street shots, where with you in the background making sounds going...
I was a Dolby artist as well. Or that's a Foley artist, sorry. I think it really just kind of it speaks to the time that it's in. In the same way that I think when we walked out of Tim Burton's first Batman in June of 1989... we just felt like this is it. This is the defining. This is going to be the quintessential Batman, and no one's ever going to be able to do this in a way that could possibly top this. And maybe somewhere along the way they'll stumble and fall, but eventually someone will come along. Especially Batman, who has been interpreted in so many different ways and so many different mediums over the decades. He's a 70 or 80 year old character now. He lends himself to really fascinating interpretations, and someone else will come along and bring something fresh to the character. As much as I realize maybe some of our listeners and Michael Uslan would never want to see like the Brave and the Bold version of the Batman brought to live action again. Like, oh my God, I would love that. Yeah. I would absolutely love something like that. Who knows? You know, who knows what creative type is out there just waiting to sink their teeth into Batman next? If
right,
Christopher Nolan is willing to give it up.
Right, because would you get like a Wes Anderson to direct it? You know, one of my favorite directors. But you know, it would be fascinating to see what he could do with Batman. I mean, it would be great. Maybe it would be stunningly great. Maybe there would be who's the guy that did like Magnolia?
Oh boy!
You know, why can't I think of him? He's got like a three named.
Is that Joe Lieberman?
Paul Thomas Anderson? No, Paul Thomas.
Yeah, Senator Joe Lieberman.
Paul Thomas Anderson. PTA. Mm-hmm. PTA. he's a great director. I mean, he did Boogie Nights, Truman Show, Moneyball. Mm-hmm. Magnolia, he knows how to play with emotion well, show us interesting sides of characters. elicit interesting emotional moments out of, you know, try to figure out ways to drag, you know, emotion out of a filmic moment. I mean, you can cut really quickly away from things, and I think that's what a lot of filmmakers tend to do, but then there are certain directors that are able to really play on your heartstrings. I think Christopher Nolan building the suspense in his films has been, you know, the key to the success of the Bat franchise for him. Knowing when to hold them, knowing when to fold them. So I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there to the Egghead Army, and answer us on Twitter. We'll read some of them next week on the show.
On Twitter.
Yeah. Well, it'll go to our Facebook fan page also. We'll ask that question on Facebook and on Twitter. Well, who do you think could direct the Bat films post Nolan? Mm-hmm. We'll throw that out there, and we'll see what suggestions you have. Who do you think mm-hmm. could pull it off? And would you, you know, who would you want to see do it, I guess, is the better question.
Those who answer Michael Bay, Clayton and I will come to your house and punch you. We will find you. There are ways to do that, right? There's like internet lookup services. We'll just find your address. Your doorbell will ring. You'll be like, oh, is that the postman? Is it someone bringing me an expensive cupcake from a boutique shop? Bam, punch in the face.
Yeah.
Okay. Just wanted you to know that. Hey, listen, I think for the last hour and 11 minutes, I've had a toaster strudel burning upstairs in the toaster, so I'm going to go.
I've had to pee, yeah.
Right. So that's going to do it for the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. You can catch us other places. For example, Clayton's on Fox and Friends every weekend. He's on live television 27 hours per day. The Fox Network allows him no less than 27 hours per day. Go check him out over there. Of course, Chikarosaurus Rex is this weekend from the Trocadero, as we said. You can also catch me over on Daddy on Board, a Friday publish, and The Trending Show, where I tend to show up from time to time on Sundays, among other stuff that we do.
And now, we're going to end the show on a little song. Just came in from one of our listeners on Twitter. They wanted to share this with us. Flam Baby on Twitter writes us, says, hey guys, have you heard the new David Byrne track yet? I haven't, and by judging by Mike's response, he hasn't either. So here it is, from Jarek Bischoff and David Byrne, the new song, Eyes. Are you familiar with this?
Not at all. Play it.
Of your eyes, so sleepy now.